Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Daniel Silliman on the life and music of contemporary Christian music pioneer Chuck Gerrard.
I don't know what this means, but I thought I was a follower of Jesus before, but now I'm really a follower of Jesus, and now I'm going to be in this church. And so he, along with a whole generation of folks, all starts showing up at Calvary Chapel and other churches in California and join what at that point was called the Jesus People Movement.
Daniel Silliman next. One of the early voices in contemporary Christian music finished his earthly pilgrimage last month at the age of 81. Chuck Gerrard and his band Love Song started performing what they called Jesus music in Southern California in the early 1970s. Spencer Dahlke is with Daniel Silliman to talk about his Christianity Today piece about Chuck Gerrard.
Sounds to me, having read your article, that Chuck Gerrard had quite the difficult upbringing. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, for people who don't know, Chuck Gerrard was sort of famous as the founder of the band Love Song and also had a vibrant solo career as a musician under his own name, Chuck Gerrard, starting in the early 70s, and really played a key role in defining the sound of the Jesus People, of developing the genre that eventually becomes contemporary Christian music. Though he preferred the title Jesus music, and really, if you listen to him, you can see it's, you know, he's very much a folk rock, very 1970s, very singer-songwriter, but all about Jesus, all about what Jesus had done in his life and in the life of his friends, and responding to that with gratitude and worship and just a deep thankfulness. He grows up in California. His family is originally Southern California, and then they moved to Northern California. And yeah, exactly as you said, it was a pretty tough upbringing. His first memories is of his father being violent. His father has very serious problems with alcohol. And he even writes in his autobiography, Rock and Roll Preacher, Chuck Gerrard writes that he thinks his first memories are actually of his father getting him drunk. Like, he seems to remember as a toddler, his dad taking him around to bars in California. And, you know, he doesn't remember much, but he's, the way he has those memories makes him think that maybe he was intoxicated. His father actually dies when he's four, quite suddenly. It's like not clear whether it was suicide or a kind of an accident or something, but it was startling. And even though he was a violent man and not a good dad, that was still quite traumatic and quite tragic. And then Gerrard was left to his mother, who was a Catholic woman who also had a pretty intense relationship with, like, New Age religion, metaphysical religion, and various occult practices, including fortune-telling. So Gerrard, you know, grew up around that. He got a little bit of religion from his Catholicism, though it seems like mostly fear of hell, and then an exposure to various kind of spiritualist occult practices, which troubled him for many years. And at the same time, a supportive mom who told him, you know, as a fortune teller, that one day he was going to play on big stages on a big piano, and sent him to get piano lessons, and then encouraged him when he started getting interested in music.
I understand from what you report, he did not come to Christ until he was 26, I think, is what you said.
Thing is, he sort of ends up in this whole journey through pop 20th century post-war pop music. Yeah, he gets involved in a band. He starts a high school band, as, you know, so many high schoolers do, called the Kestrels. And they do mostly R&B covers. This is in Santa Rosa in the 1950s, 1960s. There's an old movie called American Graffiti, which is all about youth culture at the time, that's actually set in the same town. And if you go back and watch it, it's all hip cats doing their music stuff and having slightly longer hair than their parents. And he said, yeah, that's pretty much what it was like. The Kestrels loved, you know, they didn't think of it as rock and roll quite yet, but rhythm and blues. And they were taking music styles that were popular with black young people and making them white. So sometimes they called it blue-eyed soul, which is like, we're just taking it and making it a little more this way. The Kestrels got popular in Northern California among various youth venues. They got played on the radio a couple of times. They became friends with their local DJ and then decide, what if we like try to make it? What if we try to go big? And so they're able to record a demo with like $100 from Chuck Gerard's mom. And the four of them make their way to Hollywood and various record studios and spend, you know, what sounds like a couple of days just going from studio to studio, showing up at the door with a tape. This is such an unfathomable way of doing it these days, but they were showing up. He talks even about they had an address in Hollywood and they're like, the DJ they knew a guy and they were like, all right, let's go there. And they showed up and they're like, I don't know if they're out of business or they're moved, but they're definitely not in this old building. But, you know, at the end of that journey, they found one record studio that was like, yep, we love it. We're going to sign you. We're going to produce a record. They agreed to 3.5 cents per record split between the four boys. So that was their royalty rate. That might actually be better than what you get on Spotify these days. I haven't looked, but. And so they were a youth pop band in the early 60s and had their chance to make it big. They had a hit. I find it kind of unlistenable. If you want to go back and check it out, the Kestrels, you know, they're still on streaming and on YouTube. I don't think the original members are making any of those proceeds, but that music's still out there. But there's sort of love songs, again, R&B, but not as swinging as you might think from the name of rhythm and blues. They've got a couple of hits, but, you know, it doesn't go very well, as is so often the case with these bands in the 50s. Like, they spring up, they do a little something, and then it just sort of don't develop a significant fan base or styles change or whatever. And so they fade almost as quickly as they rise to the pop charts. But it does give Gerard a foot in the door of the musical industry. He finds himself on stages with, you know, people who were the pop stars of the day, Brenda Lee, Roy Orbison, Jerry Lee Lewis, Jan and Dean, people whose names don't exactly ring out today, but were quite popular at the time. And sort of the rest of his friends quit and go home. You know, the other four, one of them's like, mom tells him it's time to come home. Another one gets married. Another one has a business opportunity. But Chuck Gerard is like, no, I'm going to stay. This is my thing. So he ends up sticking around. And even though he's under this one contract and it's a little bit sketchy, he's not technically allowed to work for other people, according to his memory and his account and his autobiography. But he ends up working for a producer named Gary Usher, who's close friends with the Beach Boys and had actually co-written several things with the Beach Boys, Brian Wilson and Mike Love. And, you know, he really thinks there's something happening in music and he's trying to capture lightning in the bottle for a second time or a third time. And so the Beach Boys are known today as one of these like transformative bands of popular music. You know, Brian Wilson is a genius and did so many things. But from the like music guy's perspective, from the industry perspective, it was like, hey, surfing's cool. Kids love surfing. Could we do another surfing band? So he like invents a band. He just gets studio musicians, writes a bunch of songs, throws them in a studio, calls them the Silly Surfers. And then like they don't have any hits. So he does it again and gets another group. And they're just professional musicians who are like, yeah, you'll pay me for a day. I'll come in and play whatever you want. And so he launches another band called the Weird O's. Weird-O-H-S. The Weird O's. And it's just like trying to invent a vision of youth culture that he can package and sell. And Chuck Gerrard's along for this ride, right? He's a songwriter. He can play piano. He's happy to be part of the party and be in it. And they actually have, I don't know, their most significant hit is this band called the Hondells. And they only write songs about Honda motorcycles. It sounds, from the perspective of history, it sounds like a weird novelty album. Like, I can't imagine, you know, Taylor Swift's next album being all Honda motorcycle songs or something. But yeah, they have their first songs is called Little Honda, and it's about the Japanese motorbike and how awesome it is. And essentially they're inventing this vision of youth culture that's all about motorcycles and cool kids who just hang out on our motorcycles and ride around. And it goes to number 9 on the charts. So Gerard gets a second shot at fame with this group. But as you hinted at, Spencer, it leads him to some really dark places, right? He has a problem with alcohol. He has a problem with alcohol pretty young. He talks about drinking and the party sort of going on for days. These sort of extended binges when you're not in the studio. You just hang out and play cards and drink and see who famous is going to drop by. And then, of course, the culture's changing, and this baby boomer hippie West Coast generation is starting to experiment with lots of other stuff. So he gets into marijuana and then psychedelics, especially LSD. He also follows, you know, various Eastern philosophies and gets into gurus, and he thinks like maybe John Lennon has the secret to the universe, and maybe John Lennon plus psychedelics will open my mind and change me. And, you know, he doesn't, it's interesting, he doesn't just think he's partying and having a good time. He thinks he is on a spiritual quest through all of this stuff. One of the moments that made me laugh a little bit, though it's also kind of sad, he also got into various diets as part of the spiritual quest and becomes a kind of extreme vegetarian, enough that at one point he's only eating avocado and asparagus. And it's like, oh man, you're gonna need something else, buddy. That's rough. But you know, he's really kind of desperate, and he's really searching, as were so many people in that generation. And also today, though it looks different, it's also like, oh yeah, this is a familiar story. People really hungry, desperate, dealing with a lot of trauma and angst in their own life and looking for answers.
It's really cool seeing how God brought him out of that to that point. Tell us how God brought Chuck Gerrard out of that life and to Christ.
The first thing that happens is actually another bumming around back of the room rock guy. He was part of a band called Fifth Cavalry, and his name was Denny Correll. And Denny is just like Chuck. He's also doing LSD and drugs and rock music and is interested in the various philosophies, but he's become convinced somehow that Jesus is the answer. Not church, not Christians, but Jesus. And so he starts telling Chuck and sort of preaching to various people that, like, you know, the spiritual quest, the answer is Jesus. And I don't even know fully exactly what that means, but the answer is Jesus. And Gerard says at one point, he sort of in a green room at the back of a gig, and Denny is sort of preaching at him, and he finally, more to get Denny off his back than anything else, like, just agrees to say, Jesus is Lord. I'm just going to do the thing that you want me to do and then, like, leave me alone. But then he's kind of pulled into it, and they actually go find a minister who will baptize them kind of spontaneously. He says, we were actually high at the time and we didn't even know this minister. We didn't really understand what we were doing, but we were on a path. We were trying. So they become, according to Gerard, kind of Christian. They're searching, and they're searching after Jesus, and they're starting to search in the Bible. But of course, they're doing it on their own. They're sort of off on their own thing. So they end up actually kind of starting a Christian commune, and they're in Southern California, and they're all professional musicians, but they spend all their time reading the New Testament and smoking marijuana and talking, and they share all things in common, and turns into kind of a disaster in a couple of different ways, but they're searching. I mean, I'm not really joking about it turning into a disaster. At one point, they decide that, like, one of the guys in their group is hearing from God and is having direct revelations about the end times, and they all end up following him to Hawaii, where he says the New Jerusalem is going to be established according to this, like, special prophecy that kind of connects to what he understands the Bible to be saying in Revelation and stuff, and is kind of his own trip, basically. Gerard follows him, and it kind of turns into a disaster, as I guess from this vantage point is not terribly surprising. He ends up, he says at one point, alone in a cave with just his guitar, just him, guitar, wet in a cave, thinking, man, dude, how'd I get here? This doesn't seem right. So he returns to the mainland and returns to music and returns to harder drugs, and then has a, like, really bad experience with LSD that really kind of scares him. And this is where the weirdness of the Jesus People movement starts impacting stuff. He tries to start a new band. He's got a couple of guys. They're calling it Love Song. They're living in a house together. They're trying to get things going. And it's Southern California in the late 60s, early 70s. And they're like picking up hitchhikers and hanging out with other folks. And they start having this thing where every hitchhiker tells them about this church called Calvary Chapel in Costa Mesa, California. And he's like, I don't know how many hitchhikers have to invite me to church. It's such a strange thing to pick up another hippie. And they're like, hey, man, have you heard about Calvary Chapel? Yeah, the last hitchhiker also told us about Calvary Chapel. And they were all skeptical of organized religion and institutional church. And even though they thought the Bible was where it's at, and even though they thought Jesus was where it's at, this connection to other people still kind of scared them. But finally, Gerard's like, well, enough people have told me about this, I should go check it out. So he slips in and sits in the back and hears Chuck Smith, the pastor, start preaching a pretty simple gospel. You're sinful. You can't get to heaven on your own. You can't reconcile with God by yourself. You're too messed up to do it on your own. Not just you, not just because you're a hippie, but all of us. We're just a little too crooked and a little too bent to fix ourselves. But thankfully, God came through the person of Jesus and did this thing for us on the cross and through his resurrection. And if you accept that, you can be reconciled with God and you can be clean. And Gerard hears this sitting in the back of the church and just starts bawling. He just starts weeping. He talks about having snot in his beard. And it just has this experience where he feels reconciled and he experiences the good work. And the good news is in his own heart and mind. And is like, all right, I don't know what this means, but I thought I was a follower of Jesus before, but now I'm really a follower of Jesus. And now I'm going to be in this church. And so he, along with a whole generation of folks, all starts showing up at Calvary Chapel and other churches in California and join what at that point was called the Jesus People Movement.
What was the Jesus Movement like? Could you tell us just like a little bit about that and how Chuck Gerard kind of played into that part of history?
I mean, it was this generation of boomers, you know, all people born after World War II in this time of pretty dramatic cultural transformation. And there was a whole chunk of them who were found by Jesus and had born again experiences and really found what they were looking for in Christ and really felt rescued from themselves and their own aspirations and their own predilections. And a lot of them were full-on hippies. There's kind of a second part of the Jesus movement, if you study it, which was churches across the country, then seeing that young people were responding to a certain kind of style and a different kind of music and a different way of articulating evangelical Christianity. And so a lot across the country, there were also like youth groups that started adopting the style, and Christian coffee houses and Christian radio stations. So the first chunk of them were kind of hardcore hippies who found Jesus and found their way into evangelical Christianity. And then a second chunk of them were evangelicals who grew up in places like Indiana and Arkansas, who then were introduced to and sort of welcomed into this hippie-inflected evangelicalism. So that's kind of the thing. But it was a huge movement, and really, really shaped and changed evangelicalism, and was seen at the time as a kind of response to the hippie movement. You know, there had been Woodstock, and there had been Altamont, and these sort of massive music festivals. And so you get like Expo 72 is the like Christian response to that, where it's Christian bands coming together and a Christian youth movement coming together and saying Jesus is the only way. And we agree with the hippies about a lot of the problems in the world: war, racism, greed, environmental catastrophe. But we think the answer is actually in Jesus and in the radical decision to follow Jesus with everything you have. And it was really a revitalization movement too. In Southern California in particular, one thing that happened that Chuck Gerard and the people around him were very involved in was new kind of music. Without the Jesus people, evangelical music was mostly hymns, was mostly... Some of it was like revival hymns from the old camp meeting. Some of it was sort of Victorian era hymns. But, you know, your normal church music was like an organ or a piano. And Gerard and those folks didn't really think that their new faith meant they had to adopt a different musical style. Gerard writes in a song at the time, he says, I want you to know I still love rock and roll. But now I have something to say. So they really just took the kind of music they were already doing and just shifted it. So the lyrics were about Jesus, about their new experience, about faith, about salvation, but in the same folk rock style of the 70s. So Love Song becomes one of the house bands at Calvary Chapel. And so thousands of kids are showing up because the hitchhikers are inviting them. People are getting baptized in the ocean. People are starting to attend these Bible studies that are happening, and they're listening to this kind of music. And then they're also starting their own bands and launching a sort of whole musical movement around this Jesus movement. There are a lot of other people there. I think people will know the name Larry Norman is a pretty famous one. Writes, I Wish We'd All Been Ready. Keith Green is maybe my favorite from the era. He does some just really impressive music. But Gerard, you know, whatever you think of Little Honda and the Hondells, or I Loved Her with the Castrels, like he had a lot of studio experience. He had professional music experience, and he knew how to organize a band and get in the studio and lay down a track. And so he is one of the leaders and really ends up shaping this sound. And a key moment in that, you know, Love Song records an album and then a second album, and that sort of launches things. They go play at Expo 72, that music festival, and that introduces them to youth across the country. Chuck also gets pulled in as a producer of the first Maranatha music album. Anybody who grew up in the 90s or even the 2000s will remember these sort of compilation CDs of worship music and contemporary Christian music. Like, if you had an evangelical mom who drove you places in a minivan, like I guarantee there were one of these CDs floating around. The first one was produced by him. He was actually uncredited. They didn't know it was going to be a whole series at the time. But yeah, he made important decisions, like how it was going to be pretty simple sounding. It wasn't going to be highly produced. There weren't going to be a lot of strings. It would be like pretty, the emphasis would be on authenticity and directness. He said he also thought it was really important. He tells Rolling Stone magazine at the time, like, we're not here on an ego trip. We're not trying to be super artistic and obscure. Like, we want to be pretty plain and pretty clear about what we're talking about. So that first album was called The Everlasting Living Jesus Music Concerts. And I think if anybody wants a sense of the sound of the era, those early love song albums with songs like Welcome Back and things like that. Welcome Back's maybe the most famous one, along with A Love Song. And that first Maranatha album gives you a strong sense. Or if you were there, you can take a trip down memory lane.
Did you have a chance while you were writing his obituary to speak with his family at all?
I didn't. There's a couple of different approaches to doing obituaries, and mine is really to try and master as much as possible the kind of written record. So, you know, he's done interviews over the years. His family's done interviews over the years. He wrote a biography. But I'm not trying to get new information and report new stuff as much as I am to sort of summarize all of the stuff that's out there. I was really appreciative of his autobiography, Rock and Roll Preacher, which I read and spent a lot of time making notes and putting that into the story.
Well, I think I just got one last question for you, Mr. Silliman. And that's just kind of like, what have you learned for yourself? Any particularly touching moments that resonated with you as you were learning and writing about Gerard's life?
I mean, I thought it was so fascinating to watch this trip he takes through the musical history and all of these connections between popular music and Christian music and the music we hear today. I mean, I don't necessarily hear worship song in church or a CCM song on Christian radio and immediately think like, I see how this is connected to the Beach Boys. But like, that whole history is there, and we have this sort of real intertwined relationship between popular culture and Christian culture. And I think it can help to see how we've always been back and forth and trying to work out our salvation in conversation with the world around us and with the parts of the culture that have shaped us for better and for worse. And, you know, it's like the ancient Israelites picking up the tools that were left to them by the Egyptians. You know, you use the stuff that's around you to try and push forward and do what God wants you to do. I'm also just so, you know, so moved by Chuck's story of searching and finding God. You know, it's a complicated story, and he talks about struggle. He talks really openly about struggles in his life, including with addiction that went on past his conversion. And sanctification is sometimes a slow process, and people have to be honest and vulnerable and part of a Christian community where people can speak into their lives. And he does that and gives us a like pretty moving account of a life that was ultimately devoted to worshiping God and helping the rest of us worship God while not deceiving himself or trying to deceive us about his own brokenness. And I deeply appreciate that.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to today's guest, Daniel Silliman. You can read his Christianity Today piece about Chuck Gerard by going to ChristianityToday.com. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's Jim Daly on the new documentary film called Truth Rising.
Truth seems to be rising right now in the culture. People that don't even claim to be Christian are saying things like, you know, children are important. Families should have children. And we say, amen. And so we wanted to give that some fuel to say even the non-believers are recognizing something's askew, something's not working, and provide fuel for that discussion and that debate.
That's tomorrow at the same time right here on His People. Thanks for listening.